From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score. Killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
The Media Project is an opportunity for some analysis, some commentary, and some days when we're really on our game, some insight into the media issues of the week. Good day to you all. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union in Albany, and Dr. Alan Chartok is here on microphone somewhere.
I'm here.
There he is, absolutely, speaking from his posh hideaway in the lovely Berkshire Mountains. But we're very glad to have you here in voice, Alan, if not in physical presence.
Are you lying?
No. I don't know what we would do without you.
I believe we should have a voice vote.
It's Ira Fussfeld, publisher emeritus of the Kingston Daily Freeman. And here is Professor Kaylin Brown from the College of St. Rose.
Hello.
Hello. Hello. How are your students these days? This is like this time of the semester when people try to buckle down, isn't it?
They are working very hard.
Good.
Wanting edits to their stories, and their wonderful group of students. And the Sister Patricia Kane Journalism Award is about to be recognized. So they've all got their contest submissions in. Very
good.
Exciting. Yes.
Good. You know, in journalism, there are a lot of contests, and we often write to the contest or something, but in fact, it does sometimes propel people to focus on their best work, right? That can make a difference.
That's exactly right. We have a number of students who have been doing journalism in the community, and they are learning how to source stories, multiple sources, use multimedia platforms to tell their stories. It's great.
Do you find that newspapers could extend a broadcast as well? Frequently write or produce stories with the sole goal of winning awards, as opposed to spending less time on producing and writing those stories and spreading themselves to cover more things?
I think there was used to be more of that. When there was more staff, you would find projects being put together that seemed to have award season in their minds. But it seems to me now that actually, because we are so tight, we really can't afford the time to do these laborious things that are fat and gorgeous, but that don't really serve the community.
Yeah, I think that may have been a question based on sour grapes from those of us who didn't win a lot of awards.
Anyway, okay, so some of the issues that confront us today, and you know, here we are in the Northeast where there's been a lot of weather recently, where the snow conspires to keep people socked in the Berkshires and that sort of thing.
Right. I think the weather is the number one issue for so many of us, because it means you can get to work or you can't get to work. It means your back will get worse because you're going to have to shovel a little bit.
Oh.
And it's a lot more direct than something like nuclear talks in North Korea. Don't you see?
Yeah, something like that. Absolutely. But the fact of the matter is, research is, as though we needed research to tell us this, research is telling us that weather is one of those beats that we ought to be assigning. The TV stations, of course, have meteorologists on staff.
Sure.
And radio, WAMC, picks up these skilled meteorologists from TV or from the University of Albany, right?
Right. And not only that, but we put them on the air for things like our Vox Pop program, which people call in for. And it's astounding how many people call in. I mean, it's the universe for the people who are concerned about the weather is just about as large as anything. I mean, you could have a show about literature, for example, and there would be passionate people who love it. But the N, the circle, is very small. But if you think about the weather, everybody gets affected by the weather.
Right. And this latest story that we're looking at reports that the Dallas Morning News, which is one of the newspapers participating in an experiment that's called the Table Stakes Experiment with funding from the Knight Foundation, has found that weather actually turns readers into subscribers. And that's what this Table Stakes is about. It's about trying to help a newsroom understand what is it that so motivates people that they're actually willing to pay you for content.
That's amazing when you think about it for a second, because everybody who has an iPhone now, right, has at least one weather app. I have three. on mine, and I compare them with each other. So who needs a newspaper if you've got it on your iPhone?
Well, I was going to say it was pretty much the same thing. I could see where the Dallas Morning News
are. Of course you were, Ira.
I'll get back to that. But I think I can see where the online internet version of any newspaper would benefit greatly by frequent updates of the weather. I'm a little surprised if it's resulting in subscriptions to the print product.
But what's interesting about this Dallas Morning News effort, where they've assigned this reporter specifically to the weather beat, is that the reporter is going out looking for sources who have been affected in some way, often terribly, by the weather. You know, they've lost their home. There's been some catastrophic event.
Right.
So when you humanize the weather that way, it often, you know, makes people relate to the story, and they feel that the newspaper recognizes their struggles. So...
Yeah, actually, of course, that's true of every kind of beat. When you humanize the story, it draws in the readers. And what they're saying is, apropos your point, Alan, about that, we do have all of these apps and the phones, but these stories tend to give context and utility in a way that a simple digital forecast on your phone might not.
Well, it's interesting because the Berkshire Eagle has an ace reporter. You know him, Rex. We all know him. He used to be the news director here, Clarence Fanto. And he goes out and he does comprehensive reports for his newspaper. Quite frequently, it's the lead story. He'll call every major vendor of weather, you know, information, and he'll put them all together in a story as if one wouldn't be complete.
I think what's interesting, too, Alan, about that beat is that a lot of people would sit in the newsroom, myself included, and if we hadn't gotten out on a story, you know, we were an open target for an editor to pick us as the weather writer. I wouldn't say it's generally an end game to want
and
to
the
be the weather reporter.
Yeah.
But simultaneously, when you think about it, because my favorite section or one of them is the obituaries, of course. And, you know, that used to be a disrespected part of the newspaper. But there have been newspapers that have done some extraordinary reporting around obituaries. And I know we're talking about the weather, but I think obituaries are very...
Disrespected by who? By the staff or by the readership?
I remember working at the Troy Record, and Marie Stanley was the obit writer, and I was shadowing her my first job. And all the other reporters thought she had the worst job in the newsroom because she was writing about dead people. That was when funeral homes were calling obit. And they were not paid then.
There's a wonderful documentary, which I think is called Obit.
It
describes and shows how the New York Times team works. Mm-hmm. It's fascinating, and I think if you are disrespectful of the Obit writers, you'd have a whole new respect for them.
Some of the most extraordinary reporters and writers on the Times staff have now gone to the Obit desk.
That's right. Was it Sam Roberts?
Sam Roberts. Richard Sandomir has gone over there.
Margaret Fox was over there. I went down to the Times. They had a special event maybe 2 years ago with their Obit writers as part of the production of this movie. And it was a pretty intimate gathering where the reporters, the obituary writers, talked about their craft. Clearly, it was a room full of an audience full of people who love to read the obituaries. But taking it to an art form is a good thing.
Now, unfortunately, what's happened at many newspapers, including my former paper, is that obituaries are now paid. And so they're not treated the way a news story ought to be treated, which is what obituaries were. If you have somebody prominent who dies, that an obituary will be written in the old-fashioned way. But if you're not, you call in and you start reading these obits, and they sound like, you know, family memoriams.
I qualify? In other words...
Yes, you would qualify. You're prominent enough. And would you give us a date, please, so I can alert the newsroom? By the way, what I was going to say earlier was I hadn't been on the program about 5 weeks, but I have listened to the podcast, and I wanted to sum up my opinion of the programs by saying I disagree with Alan. So.
I just throw in there, Alan, can I write your obit?
Yeah, that would be a good story.
Sure.
I would love to write it.
Yeah. Alan, that would be a great story, you know. I mean, with all due respect, not that we're eager for it, but it'll be a great story and well-read and, you know.
I have a friend, an elderly gentleman, who is going to outlive me, no doubt, and he has already written his own obituary.
Ah, good.
So that the family will have it to submit to his local newspaper.
That's very thoughtful.
And our listeners actually would do a big favor to their families if they would at least put together some piece of writing that describes what they want in their obituary, because that is an onus to put upon your family that they do not deserve.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Wait a second. How do you know they don't deserve it?
Because it is... You're right. Your family might, Alan.
No, but people really appreciate it. You talk about audience building. You know, our wonderful reporter, Paul Grondahl, now the director of the New York State Writers Institute, was such a terrific writer on so many things, but especially on writing about people prominent in the community who had died. And he would find these bits and pieces and he would weave them into these beautiful narratives. And so you were a lucky person if you got a full five-star Grondahl farewell. And since he's left us, he writes once a week for us now a column. Now he runs the Writers Institute. And we don't have really quite that strength in writing about people who've left. We've got to figure it out because I do think people really love it.
Snowstorms and obits. What a lively way to open the
show. But I have one last question on the obit question. Rexy, and you know it better than anybody because you follow these things, but how popular are obits compared to everything else? I mean, in the Shartok House, we read the letters to the editor. I know that's very popular.
Yeah.
I follow Gasoline Alley, but that's only because I'm very old.
Gasoline Alley, wow. Sluggo? Is Sluggo still there?
No, Sluggo's not there anymore.
He was in Nancy.
No, it was Nancy, right. Lord Plushbottom used to be in Gasoline Alley. Yeah.
So tell me, Rex, is obituary reading at the top of people's preferences?
It depends on whether you believe what people tell you. When you do a readership survey, you would think that what people read all the time, what they just cry out for, is investigative and watchdog local reporting, because that's what everybody tells you is what they want. And so we respond to that. But you do have to wonder when you, of course, the page views alone does not give you a sensibility. We are now paying more attention to the metric called sessions. That is how many times a person actually goes to TimesUnion.com, regardless of how many pages they view. Because if they're just looking at, say, two pages, but they read everything on those two pages, and that's a nice long story, you have kept them engaged for a while, and that means that it's probably a story that is good enough that they're willing to pay for it. So anyway, I guess I'm dodging your question. I don't really know the metrics.
We always thought obituaries and police news was what sold the newspaper.
And corrections.
Yeah, if you can find them.
Oh, they find them, believe me. This is the Media Project, by the way, from Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to share your thoughts, media@wamc.org. We thank you very much for joining us. Alan Shartok is out there. Ira Fussfeld.
even when he's here, he's out there.
Kaylin Brown and I'm Rex Smith. I guess last week when I was not with you all, I was off down in Texas, there was some conversation about this woman who has joined CNN, a woman named Sarah Isger. Bear in mind, this is someone with no journalism experience. She worked for Jeff Sessions when he was the Attorney General. She referred to CNN as Clinton News Network. And now she has been hired by CNN to be their political editor.
Very strange. Very strange. One can only think, Rex, that they're sitting up there in their executive offices, the CNN people, saying, well, you know, the Trump people are after us and all these other people are after us. And there was a deal. Remember the deal that just got approved by the judge, which was CNN was combining with somebody else. Who was that? Anybody remember?
Well, you're talking about the Time Warner Spectrum deal. Right.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Right.
Right. And so we know that this president is not above retribution. And when I read that story that you're referring to about this CNN, basically, doubter assuming control, I said, I wonder if they're trying to buy them off a little bit. I didn't say, I think they're trying to buy her off, because that might be libelous. I said, I wonder if. Get it?
Well, I think that's a fair conclusion to draw. I don't know if that's the reason, but I will tell you, in my opinion, particularly these days where there are so many quality journalists who are out of work around this country, that CNN could not have hurt itself if it hired somebody with experience. It's hard to describe. Why would one of the major broadcast news operations go out and hire somebody for a prominent position just before the election who has not had any experience?
Unless the title doesn't mean what she's really doing. If she's called political editor, maybe she's not really going to be in charge of the political coverage. Maybe it's just a title. I don't know. I can't imagine. But Margaret Sullivan, the terrific media writer now for The Washington Post, said that it strongly suggests that the network's big thinkers, including Ed Hunter, Jeff Zucker, are aiming for the kind of false fairness, a defense of both sides are equal kind of political coverage that inevitably fails to serve the voting public.
Exactly, exactly. I think that's a very good analysis.
Well, I hope if she has any influence, the first thing she does is tell CNN they don't need 10 people at a panel to discuss a news story. It's just too many people and too many voices, and none of them get heard long enough. And there's no reason why, if they want to have a representation of various points of views, that they can't have it with four people instead of 10 people, as they did yesterday as we speak after the Cohen hearings.
I got to think about that one, Ira. As you know, my first position is to disagree with you.
Correct.
And in this case, you may make a little sense.
Wow.
If this woman was a political operative, she worked for Sessions, so we'll say she was, it seems that CNN is making a big mistake in that trying to pretend that by hiring someone on the other side of the aisle, they have now made their information or the news they deliver more fair and balanced. I trust that the audience would see through that, but I agree with Ira. I mean, why not hire a real journalist?
I think Judy Patrick on this program has been very eloquent about her disapproval of the people who are brought onto TV from the political world and often hop right back. And I just think there are too many quality journalism, nonpartisan people who they can bring on the air without resorting to former politicians like Rick Santorum, for example, or whomever his counterpart might be on the left.
But of course, they're doing commentary. What's different about this is that this is supposedly someone who's going to be setting news standards and directing some of the coverage. To have somebody in that role who's never been a journalist, who has only been a flack. And I say that with all due respect. I was a flack for 4 years myself, you know. But I mean all due respect. And that is a certain amount only. Because it just seems that there are, I agree with you, there are great journalists out there who could do this job. And it just makes you wonder what is in their thinking. And I don't think that CNN has explained it well. This is one of those situations where you would think that the kind of transparency that journalists expect of other businesses ought to be visited upon CNN.
Right. They did not explain it well, and they did not explain it well to their own staff, many of whom are quite upset about it.
It's interesting to think about it, though, because what if an individual like this Isker, who is now hired by CNN, were working at the Washington Post, and this was a person through whom all stories went to check on the balance of the story? Would someone at the Washington Post in a position being an extra gatekeeper or fact checker, would that person have perhaps help the Washington Post not end up in a lawsuit? You know, perhaps it's a liability question. Maybe that's why they hired her.
Well,
we can only imagine.
Alan, what's your joke about Ishtar?
Ish-terrible.
Oh, Ish-terrible. That's the joke about Isker now.
I knew it was familiar. That's right, because Gene Shalit's best line ever was he reviewed Ishtar, the movie, and he said, Ishtar, Ish-terrible.
Her name is Isker.
You're welcome for teeing you up.
That's right. Very kind.
I do. Thank you.
We were speaking earlier, by the way, before we get off the topic entirely, about research into media trends and what readers are looking for. There's a project up underway at the American Press Institute called the Media Insight Project. One of the things that it tells us, and this kind of aims toward what we were just talking about with CNN, an interview here that we're reading with a guy who's running this says, as journalists, we can build our credibility and loyalty by better explaining ourselves to audiences and by being their partners in navigating a noisy news environment. You know, the ecosystem of news has changed so much with digital platforms that people have never heard of now delivering news, with print newspapers looking very different from what they used to in the sense of what they all cover. And a good idea is to try to explain that to people. And again, the CNN didn't do that in this case. And we often don't do that with our reporting. You know, we assume that readers understand, for example, the difference between a straight news story and an opinion piece. And maybe we don't label it well enough.
Wasn't your column originally to do that sort of thing? I know years ago I wrote a column every week of explaining why it is we did what we did. And of all the things I did once I left sports, that was the one that was best received. They might not have agreed with the column and the reasoning we had for making a decision, but they appreciated us explaining it, and they appreciated that we didn't just throw it on the wall. There was a reason for what it was we do. And most newspapers and broadcasts don't do that, and I think it's important.
Yeah. Yeah, my column started as just that. I ended up feeling as though I was sounding the same every week.
Preaching.
I was sounding defensive,
yeah.
And here's what we're doing, and here's why. And then, of course, when our national dialogue, or in effect, the sociology of the country got so awkward that I thought maybe I should do a little commentary on our community's response to things. So my column's a little bit
Well, unfortunately,
now.
If every newspaper and broadcast outlet did try to do that today, in today's atmosphere, people wouldn't believe them, where
yeah.
It's an us versus them mentality.
I don't know. I read Rex's column religiously. The first thing I read when I, you know, get up in the morning and get the Times Union, and I'm a big fan of
well,
what
thank
you do and your inside the industry insights. It's terrific.
No, thank you.
You skim it first to make sure your name's not in it. Or vice versa.
Or what? No,
you don't have to worry
name?
About that. No, you don't have to worry about that. The New York Times puts my name in, but not the Times.
Yeah. So there are other strategies that the news industry can use to help readers and listeners and viewers all understand or get inside insight into how journalism is happening in simple ways. When a reporter writes a story and may have relied on an email interview, simply telling the reader that it was an email through which the reporter received her or his information mm-hmm. is a little bit of an insight for the reader to understand that's where they're getting their information. Or you tell them that you interviewed them on City Hall steps. But
yes.
There are ways to let readers in.
That's a really good point. That's actually a little good lesson I'm going to try to take that one back to the newsroom today, Professor. Thank you.
Just hire my students. They know it already.
Would that I had positions to fill.
Sorry, I
yes,
can't help
absolutely.
It.
It's a good thing. So, you know, speaking of, we talk a little bit about flackery. There is an interesting piece in Columbia Journalism Review this week from PR executives talking about what they really think of journalists. Because, you know, there are more PR people in America than there are journalists. I think it may be even by a margin.
I was going to say by a wide margin.
Yeah, I think it might be 5-1. And so one of the things that I thought was interesting was a publicist for the auto industry says that a lot of his work comes down to relationships with journalists. So that when journalists are under pressure, moving fast, making quick decisions about what to do, what to believe, he wants to be one of the first calls. And journalists, of course, know that these publicists are biased, but they want to have a relationship with journalists on that beat. And I think that's a, you know, pretty good insight.
Not only that, think about the rules. And then you know the rules, Rex, because you've worked both sides of the street. Somebody takes 2 days to get back to you. You're not interested in them as a potential source. Somebody gets back to you time after time after time. I have two very good friends who are top newsmakers in the Times and everywhere else. And that's our Blair Horner, who does commentary for us at WMC, and Jerry Benjamin at New Pulse. And they know to return telephone calls. And as a result, you don't want to get burned a second time by calling somebody who's not going to call you back.
Yeah.
But they're not flacks. They have their own positions,
no.
And you're using them as experts. The flacks are the ones that are derelict if they're not returning phone calls.
You know what? Good hit, Ira. I respect you for calling me up short on that, but...
Sorry, I didn't mean to laugh.
But
can't say much.
The rules apply not only to flacks, but to everybody else.
Yeah. Actually, there's a great quote here, and as we end our show, I just wanted to share this. It's true. A flack says, "My job is not to communicate with journalists, it's to communicate through them." And that is why, you know, we're sometimes the filter. We're taking what they want, and they just want to get their words out through us. So it's important to bear in mind whenever you see a name as a spokesman. Anyway,
sounds like a fish. Sounds like a fish. Gefilte fish.
I got to get out of here. Ira Fussfeld offering his blessings to Alan Shartok. And I'm grateful for Kaylin Brown. And I'm Rex Smith. And thanks to all of you and to our producer, Dave Gustina. It's the Media Project.
They used to work like hell just for romance. But finally, the movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants. They organized a union to get a living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. when they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild, got a free news.
The Media Project is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Alan Chartok is CEO of WAMC, professor emeritus at the State University of New York, commentator, columnist, and author. Rex Smith is editor of the Times Union. Kalen Brown is the chair of the Department of Communications at the College of St. Rose. And Ira Fussfeld is the publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman. You can listen to or podcast The Media Project anytime at WAMC.org or just download the WAMC app for your iPhone or Android at the Play Store today. Thanks for listening.
Publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give 3 cheers for freedom of the press.